Okay.
So welcome again. I think this is the last meeting in this year. So next week I see that we have already holidays, which is not the worst method. So is there anything important, like always, question which you had the last week which you want to pose at the beginning? If not, then I will continue. I don't see any hands going up. There is one more thing. You will get an email, so everybody who is on Moodle will, or you should have received already an email an hour ago or something like this. I record the lecture. This is just for the preparation of your exam. Yeah, so if you want to hear something or you want to re-listen something during the courses, you can do it. I don't, this is not for sending it to other people. Yeah, so this is just a help for you to, today one really has to be, I have many lectures online and you always post them freely on the internet. But since the internet started to change a little bit and also is used to misuse people, so I became a little bit more, careful about putting everything into the internet. Yeah, because this is a cultural thing. I would love to give it to everybody, yeah? But I also made my experience that one, unfortunately, I think this is a dangerous development for society, but it is as it is. I cannot, as a single person, change this thing. So please, I gave you this as a help for your examination so that you can look into what he said, but please don't put it on without my approval. Yeah, that you send it. Okay, is there a question about this? Because we have three more meetings, I think, in January, the service already examination. And why do I not publish them always at the beginning? That's also an experience which I did this in former times, but as you see, we are 76 people who are attending this course, I think, according to Moodle, and you see that probably 76 people will come to the exam, and now probably we have been an average 20 to 40 people in this group, if there was it 40 months. And if I put it always, this is my experience in COVID, if I put it online every week, so I can stand here in front with 5 people. Because all others will just listen to the recordings and will not be here physically, which is a little bit depressing for me as a lecturer here in front. Okay, so is there any question concerning the exam or this kind of thing from your side? Is everything clear? It's written over on Google, so you... Yeah. Okay, that's great. So administrative stuff, we can do it. We can go back to the topic of the heart, which I think is more interesting, I hope, for all of us. Okay, so this is what we... No, the other one we had last, this was the last slide which we had. So just to remember you, we were speaking about this picture of a typical picture of Sushumna. And now I would like to go to the last slide of the, where we are in the period of the Upanishads still. So we were going a little bit through the time, starting with the Rigveda. To remember you, and then we go now with the end of the Veda, with Vedanta, and this I will finish today, and then today we will make another step to Kashmir. So we make a jump off again, about 1,500 years or more. Yeah? So we always jump about 1,500 years through the history. Which is a kind of time machine, as I would call it. Okay, so we are going to the Katha, one Katha Upanishad. We have one passage here from the Katha Upanishad. I think it's already the last one, Upanishad, then we go, or the second one. So I said to, before I start, I said I would identify also a certain kind of development between the Rig Veda time. This was my painting to remember again about Rig Veda time, and this is a typical painting of my yoga teacher, Desika Cha, from the book Courageousness in Yoga. So this is the way how it's very often used in a similar way, or you can see the paintings and images which will look quite similar in the traditions of Indian philosophy if you look into yoga books or something like this. So I said that for me, between these time travel of about 1,500 years, there is also something that changed. So not everything, I think they still look a certain way of similar, they have some similarity, but also there is some difference what happened between the beginning of the Veda and the end of the Veda. Of course, there was not always everything all kept the same. Through all these thousands of years, I think this would be probably a wrong perception of Indian philosophy that they spoke about the eternal, so this means that nothing has changed at all. In Indian, there is all, and of course, this is now very typical Western, that we see general logic. So I would say this is a very typical way of how Western groups go through a history. They go through it chronologically, which of course is questionable. Yeah? What I'm doing, but I think it's very typical from our culture background to do what I'm doing right now, to have Hegel in a certain way in the back and thinking the mediation of the systematic and the historical. And so. So I quote here, I still have not said what I wanted to say. So I ended last week with the thesis. That's really a thesis, so of course everybody can go counter it or question it. But my impression is, if I go through the text, there is already out of the Christian culture a kind of a focus on the human being, so it becomes more anthropological. That would be a kind of historical trait that I would identify. So why in the beginning of the Veda, these things what we were speaking about now the last months were strongly cosmological. Yeah? So it was really, when they spoke of the heart, they had more a cosmological heart in their mind. So, of course, the human heart stands in a relation to that cosmic heart, but when they spoke of the heart, they had something like the whole being. and this is the center, the heart is in a certain way the center of all beings, which I would say it's cosmological from our way. So it's not just something that is at work or operative in the human body, but that is operative in the plants, and even in the molecules, if it becomes a kind of metaphor of consciousness as such, it would be even that they are pulsating in the hearts. It's much more than you have something like, the different seasons of the year. Yeah, so you have spring and you have summer and you have autumn and winter. So that will be a kind of cosmic pulse of time. Yeah? And all, not just the human bodies, have this in a certain way as a natural clock of their heart and rhythm, how they live their life. But this is also important for plants or animals or other beings. And in a certain way, I would claim that the rhythm of the molecules is in a certain way pulsating in that rhythm of nature or cosmos. And of course, when I say nature or cosmos, you should know, especially as philosophy students, that nature and cosmos was the same in Greek. So in the very back of, if you want to have this kind of thing. But at the beginning of so-called European philosophy, physics, nature was not, as you should all know, a part which is opposite to culture or to cosmos, but it was the word for we. Especially in pre-Socratic, they were not just nature philosophers, because nature for them, physics meant the cosmos. It was the being of all beings and not just one part of being. And when you say pre-Socratic philosophers were philosophers of nature, and you use the term in our contemporary sense, you are absolutely wrong. This is not nature, but this is the whole coming into being of everything. In a certain way, what physics means. And this is what I end, this is where I ended last hour, that I said if I have to compare these two images, I would say the one is very cosmic, so you see the person, the human body being in the whole environmental, we could also say. So it's not, why this is much more Greek. I would say this is typical Greek. So even if it is used in any yoga book, this is very Greek, because what is important in the Greek philosophy of the body is the contour, the shape, so the form. So this is what we have inherited in some way from the Greeks, that we, I think this is not able. Sorry if it's Spanish. I think this is a strong influence already of European philosophy, that you think that what is the very heart of a body being is its contour, its shape. But this is Greek, this is Greek thinking, that you think the chair ends at the surface of its contour. And so when I have this chair, this is the body of the chair, and here, this is no more the body of the chair. This is great. It's very difficult for us to overcome this, because this is so deeply in our language, in our culture, that we have, when you have, for instance, Eastern philosophy, they would always say, it's not just form, it's formless form. So you can never reduce a body to the form, but you will always have to say it's formless form, it's empty form, as East Asian philosophy would strongly. I think this would be a non-Greek, non-European, under 1,000 quotations, way of understanding bodies. As I already said, they are participating in a field. Therefore, I think that really this is not just arbitrary, that modern physics since 19th century is in a certain way overcoming Euclidean, which says interesting. It's coming, the overcoming of Euclidean geometry, which is of course Greek understanding. And that means the body becomes definite, even the words which we have, through the surface of its contour. And from there my body ends here at the surface of my contour. This is Greek. And this would be, for me, strongly, so this is a way of understanding what you have. Here you have a very clear shape. This is not a cloud or something like this. This is a very Greek way of seeing it. It has a very clear, and it has a clear, this body exists inside of the contour, and the outside is not even mentioned. So it's not part of the picture. It's very Greek that you have this contour, and there is only form, and the non-form is the outside or the other of the form. I think this is not true for any ancient culture. No, I think they have not experienced, I would even say they have physically not experienced bodies as being defined by the shape of the body. That's only one aspect of. But it's not, and it's very clear that this does not get work. We should learn here really from children, because, for example, when we have the typical example of the sun, nobody suddenly thinks Greek. Because with the sun, we see very clearly that it has at least two bodies. It has the body of the ball, and then we make rays. So we have already two bodies of one body. So the sun is therefore very an image that is important to understand bodies. And even in Plato, if I go back to Greek philosophy, it's also the typical body that learns us to understand something, to see and experience bodies differently. Because as I said so often now, also my body in the moment when I speak, you cannot reduce my body anymore to my form. My speech is an expression and an Ausdruck, as we say. So if you shan't see me here as you see the sun. It would be really make if I make a childish picture of myself, a ball here, it's me, and then you would make rays if you make a naive painting, because I'm obviously now existing in the space like a sun. Much more if I do naive painting, if I schematize. As Kant would say, if I start to think something which is non-figurative, figurative, this is Greek schema. So I schematize, all what I do here is making a diagram or schematize, as Kant would say, I'm schematizing and trying to create a picture of concepts. And that translation, Kant is very important, if you have the critique of pure reason, really that's the hard thing, what can change between the A and B edition. It's just that the schematism changed. This was part of my habilitation, so I can promise you that I could not speak quite long on this problem, the problem of schema in Kant. But that's really figurative speech. I try always here to schematize a concept. And this is that I try to translate something non-figurative in something figurative. And figure means schema in Greek. So I schematize. And we have this in all, this is a huge problem. This is also I just go to one political thing. If we now have things, this is at the very core also of epistemology of time, and it is very core of many political discourses. So let's take the word whiteness. So we can say whiteness is I don't mean a real person, but this is a structural thing. Okay, good. Whiteness does not mean me as a white man, but it means an abstract structural component, whiteness and not the thing. Okay, so I have now an abstract term. And now I have the problem of the schematizing problem. Because Kant would say, if now I have this abstract notion of whiteness, then I have the problem, if I just take it structurally, I would not be allowed to translate it figuratively to any figure in this world. If you really do structuralism, this is why I became post-structuralist and myself, if you really would have this a simply structural notion, you would not be allowed to schematize it and try to find anybody in the world that has the attribute of being. Otherwise, coming to the problem of the schema, you try to make it figurative means that you have this general notion, but now you want to apply it to empirical bodies, people like me. But then you have a big epistemological problem, because you say it's just structural, and in the second place you say, but we have to make it real. And with making it real, you say, in a Kantian term, that you want to make it figurative. But making it figurative means that you want to find empirical bodies who have the attribute of the so-called abstract term. So how can an abstract, this is the kind of consumer, how can an abstract term be translated? This is exactly the word of Kant, angewendet in German. How can you take abstract concepts and apply? That's the Kant word, anwendung. How can you anwend them to empirical beings? So how can an abstract concept be translated into an attribute of an empirical body? This is the problem of semantism, which is a very hard problem, hard. I mean, not only hard, but also hard. It is a core problem of the whole epistemology of Kant in his critique of pure reason. How does semantism work? And exactly here, he makes the biggest revisions between the A and the B edition of his critique of pure reason. In a certain way, one could say, well, Kant was not satisfied with solving this problem, which became so political, you know? In his A, he could not really, he said, we need a better solution for this. Yeah? How are, and this literally Kant, schematism means how can you translate an abstract term into a figurative term. What I do all the time here in this lecture, what I try to figure. So that is the post-structuralist problem, as I would read it, that you cannot be a pure structuralist. Because if you really would be, you would not be allowed to make it real. Yeah? But this is exactly when you become political what you want. You would not like have the word with whiteness, but you want to then apply it to certain bodies which have the best. And of course, I take this whiteness only as one example. You could do this with all other political terms which are. So you want to have them empirical, but you say they should be just structured. But that brings you to the epistemological problem of schematism. Yeah? You want to, you say, it's not figurative, but then you apply it to figurative thinking. You have to, because otherwise you cannot go into the political space. Yeah? So that's a very, I just wanted to very shortly allude to this problem. Yeah? And it should, yeah. Also to make it not just a historical, this is why I like intercultural philosophy, because we are not just doing here history of Indian philosophy, but in a certain way we can also try to do contemporary philosophy with reading these kind of things, because they bring us to certain problems which are probably very present right now in our times. So please give me the answer on how does schematism work when you speak about this. Yeah? This is really, I don't say that this is easy to solve, but this is one of the core problems of Kant's critique. That we find this now then in the political without him, this is just because Kant had a cultural problem. So when I say Kant, I don't mean just a person Kant. But Kant is such a big thinker because he thought something which is relevant not for him personally only, but which is a problem that pops up in our culture. In the circle. So otherwise he's no philosopher, otherwise he does private therapy or something like that. So also nothing to do against private person, but I will not call you a philosopher. If you go to psychoanalysis, that's a good thing, but you are not. Doing philosophy, yeah, in a certain way. Or you start to use your experience as a critique, for example, of certain discourses, then you start to take your experience from psychoanalysis to become a voice that criticizes certain things in the canon of philosophy. So that's possible, of course. Yeah. So that's just one thing, because I try to reflect also what I'm doing here in a critical way. So making figures is also a quite dangerous zone which we go through, because I'm constantly translating non-figurative structures into trying to create an image of them, in order to make them empiric. And I think this has a good side, but it's also, we should also be, and this is the meaning of critiquing, kind of know the limits of this process. This does not mean down up or down down, but of course critiquing kind of means knowing the limits. Seeing the limits of something, what you do, and not down up and down down. This has with critique of philosophical nothing to do. It's really the opposite of critique.
Just very fast, the schematismus problem, is it not just because there's a qualitative difference between ideas and matter? And this is what Plato also says, that like the ideas can just always, they are related on the matter. They can transform itself into matter, but they are related on the matter. And the matter always gives the ideas the end form. So the idea is always perfect, but the materialization of the idea in the world always differs from the idea itself because it's founded on the qualitative matter.
Of course, this is the way, thank you, this is the way how Plato in certain ways says that they are immaterial. I would be, is this really a big question? I cannot answer it because this would, my reading would, we have to be very careful with how far do we follow Plato? And how far do we criticize Plato like Deleuze did it, like Nietzsche did it? I'm not. This brings me in the next confusion. Yeah, how far to the answer here? Or trying to answer, yeah. So for me, it's very dangerous again if you call them non material. Because that is, that brings us in a lot of difficult problems, which we find over thousands of years. So that we are coming closely, as Nietzsche would say, in a hierarchical, to use the contemporary terms, discrimination of matter. Because there's quickly a hierarchy that this is higher and matter is less, and we come into discourses which I find problematic. So my solution would be that we should think matter in a verbal sense. Then I could agree. And this is for me, just to give you something, what I have in mind, because this is of course, I again read others. So when I say this is not another but a quote also of discourses. And I would like to bring in here some discourses from new materialism where you have to think matter rather as a process than as a factual solid body. So if you have that notion of matter as a processual thing of maturing, as they would say, then I would say, okay, under these conditions I could affirm what you said. But we then have to deconstruct in a certain way what people usually understand from matter being exactly the solid thing. So if I have the matter, this is the solid basis. But if I have matter in a new materialistic sense, it would not be solid at all. It would be processional. So it's much more a mattering of. So ideas are immaterial only insofar as they are virtual in the Deleuzian sense, and that means they have the possibility. And they are insensible because they are just possible. So the insensuality or the non-materiality of ideas for me would be acceptable if I had translated it into the sense of being virtual. And virtual ideas, that means that they are possible materials. Yeah? And we have to very strongly, but this is lost, in the way that they are eternal possibilities. Yeah? But when I say this word, I'm not sure whether anybody understands what I mean, because we use this word very differently today. So I would have to think of Shelley and these people. Yeah? He would say eternal possibilities, these are eternal possibilities. But we have, I think today it's very difficult to understand what an internal possibility should be, because we have lost that trait of tradition, usually. So we would have to do quite a lot of shit in order to make sense out of this. Okay. Yeah, that was the thing. That I said, this is much more going now anthropological understanding or image of our being. So the human body becomes an important in the end of the day, a central topic of the heart, and it's not so much cosmic anymore, more as it has been in the Rig Veda at the beginning of the day. I quote from the Katha Upanishad. There are 101 channels of the heart. One of these passes up to the crown of the head. Going up by it, one goes to immortality. The others are for departing in various directions. A person of the measure of the thumb is the inner soul. Antara, Atman, is very often a word also for the heart, because it means inner. Yeah? So whenever this Antara comes, Atman, of course, is the self. I would translate it the self, not the soul. So it is the inner self. Yeah. And very often, in the very moment where you come to Antara, it is very often associated with the heart. And you go into the inner being, which is the bowl of the heart. The inner soul or the inner self, ever seated in the heart of creatures. Okay, so at the end, I just wanted to bring these two pictures together and want to show you how one could make sense in a certain way or contextualize this passage, which if you just read it and you don't contextualize it, I think it makes no sense in our contemporary culture. If people have not context of cultural context. So I hope that it became a little bit more clear now how one could interpret this passage from the Katha Upanishad after 2 months reading and discussing and analyzing these texts. So there are 101 channels of the heart. So what would this mean if you translate it to our times? What do they mean with the heart has 101, so one central and 100 other channels. So how would you translate it? What do they mean? I have some bad work.
It's about the connection then. When the heart has channels, the channels are there to connect the heart with something. So as we did last time, we could also say it's like maybe the vessels, maybe the nerves in this when we would talk about the physical heart.
So one thing is first. It's not the organ, but if we try to translate it into anatomy, we would have said you have to see the picture of the sun, as I said. It's not just the organ, but the organ has rays, it has nadis, it has rivers, as the Veda would say. It has, if I translate it then again, we have rivers in the bodies, and of course we would immediately identify with the blood circulation through the body or the nerve, the streams, electromagnetic streams that are pulsating through our whole body in 1,000 channels. Of course 100 here does not mean exactly 100, but it means that in 100 channels, obviously, this means that there is a whole river system. This is how the river will call it. There are thousands of rivers, streams going through our but they are circulating like the nerves, yeah, of electromagnetic circulation, chemical circulation. This whole a body is something that is circular. Yeah, it's not defined by the shape. This is creepy. Yeah? Because they would even say in the Rig Veda, they would even say, so now we say, okay, these are rivers which are going, I can understand. So these primitive, critical. So these so called archaic culture, yeah, they didn't know what we know today. Yeah? So this is the habit of today, and we know much better than them. Ironically, of course, please. So they had to think that there are hundreds or thousands streams going throughout it, but they would even say, especially at the beginning of the Veda, these streams in my bodies are connected with the stream, for example, of the rays of the sun. They then think environment, and they think in a certain way from the cosmic or nature perspective. So when the sun, it's written in hundreds of rays of you. When the sun has their rays, they are sending their soma to us. Yeah? So this is a river. And even today, as we say, this is not so stupid as you, because between, as I said it many times, in their language, it would be when the rains come from the sun to the earth, there is a kind of floating ocean between. Okay, we call it electromagnetic field, sounds much more scientific than a lunar ocean, yeah? A sun ocean that is between the sun and between the sea. And of course, this sun ocean of electromagnetic lives and life is in connection with our inner body, yeah? Anta, yeah? It has to do something, it's not just, it's ecological, but naturally, yeah? They would never come to the idea that we have a blood circulation and that we have a nervous system within our body that is separated from the whole of nature, which also has electromagnetic streams and have also all these kind of circular structures. So that is for me one change that already goes from the weather, that this becomes much more now concentrated on what is going on as flows in the human body. Then what is going on as a cosmic flow of the whole nature in a certain way that has this way of things. And of course, okay, so we could say, yeah, our body is not first defined philosophically by the contour, but by circulating rivers, I would say, yeah? Electromagnetic streams are going through our bodies, yeah? And blood circulation, it's all circular. And what we have as solid system is just an effect of this circle. If the blood circle would not be circular, you would become sick and die. Yeah? Because you are no more, you have no constant blood circle anymore. For them, circle always would mean that it became balanced and solid. If you don't have it circular, but this is very, you know, when you have ecology discourses today, and we say nachhaltig, and now we have to be zirkuläre Wirtschaft. Okay, probably we can learn something. Because a circle makes something solid, it makes it nachhaltig. If you have no blood circulation that works, you will die soon because the blood runs away and you will die. Simply, you are no more there. Because it's not a circle, it is just going into one direction and therefore it will be quite soon empty. There is no circulation, there is not a giving and a coming back in a certain way. So it's not nachhaltig, to use a fashionable term. It's simply not nachhaltig. So if you think of a circular system of economy, for example, you exactly try to make it circular. That means that we are not spending everything, taking everything out of our ocean, yeah, to use that picture, but giving nothing back. This goes good for a certain time, but it will not be enough to make it more popular. And that's the same also with your health. You can probably try to go to the fitness center and make you stronger and a little bit more pushing you, go higher and higher. But if it's not creating a circular system, it will be very temporary. So you lose 7 kilo weight, but the problem is if it's not circular, you will gain the weight after 3 weeks. Yeah. And so it's not solid, it's not happening, it's not circular. This is why the circulation was so important, because the circle does create solidity. It creates solidity. It's not that you have to make it circle. It's not just given as a thing. And if you lose the circulation, then you lose balance. So if you want to be healthy in their sense, you have to find where you lose these energies, for example, in your body, because they are not in an unhealthy circle. So that can probably be for a short moment very good for you, but it will not be solid, yeah? In that way. It will not give you a constant thing. It is not so, yes, solid. Okay, so there are 100 channels. They serve through our body and through nature, they would say. Yeah, they are not just human, they are post-human thinkers, because these circles you do not just find in the human body, but of course in the, especially in the year, yeah, that is coming back circular, in the seasons that coming back, the day, the morning and the night that is coming back. So this is regular. So you find this circle anywhere in nature, and not just in the human body, but of course the human body suddenly becomes more and more a center of, because if I take it very classical, they would say, so it becomes a problem, how can you live this circulation? But within nature, of course they would say. So how can you go with nature and having a circular life within big circles of nature? Yeah. And not going in ants, nature, or even as Fichte says, nature is just the material for human makings. And this is how matter became material. Yeah. Fichte says that nature, and even Kant at the beginning of the anthropology, is nature is just for the use of human beings. Now here you can see really a big change in the cultural way of thinking. And the one thing, you are one smaller circle in a big cosmic circle, and in the other you say they are ready at hand to be used for our species. This is really at least the beginning of the anthropology of Kant, which is terrible. Or read Fichte, yeah, where he promotes Welthandel to be the big liberal thing that will free us all, so globalization in a certain way. And in that way, it, because we are now in the thing where we just use nature. This is not so, yeah, for a philosopher at least, this is not far away from the time, temporality of culture. This is how we today still think in mass. Yeah. And there you see that a certain critique of modernity has its right. Yeah, I think, you know, I hope that no of the, especially from your younger generation, will not be a little bit shocked when one reads these passages from Kant and from Fichte. Yeah. If we in a certain way see that. Yeah, and I admire them. Yeah. I think they are really big thinkers, but we cannot just take them all in one. Yeah, as they were so gurus which you cannot criticize. They are in kind of non-failure status. I think this would be quite problematic for me. Yeah. But this does not mean that we can learn really a lot. And anything like, for example, I could not have spoken with you on charitism and how to be become. So I think one can learn a lot from them, but of course, we are also the nice thing of modernity is also that they are no laws. They are not in a state of God which you cannot criticize. And so I think both is necessary in a certain way. To respect them because they have done great and good work. But on the other lines, to be able to criticize them, and I think those people which I mentioned would not have something against it to criticize, neither Fichte nor Kant. Okay, so we have the 100 channels, but now they say there are 100 in one channel. Yeah? So what do they mean? So we have now this rather floating understanding of nature, and they have this nature is pulsating through the circles of the human beings and bodies. And on the other side, there is not just this 100, but there is one. Okay. So how do we have this already? What do they usually mean when they say the one channel? It's also written here in the diagram. How do you call, do they usually in any traditions? In Kashmir Shaivism, we hear that they criticize a little bit this not concept, but in most of the Indian tradition, it is quite over hundreds and hundreds of years. It is. This is the famous Sushumna channel, which, in a certain way, when I would have to translate it in our contemporary, this is always, I say, translate in order to emphasize that this is also problematic. Yeah? In a certain way, but otherwise I highly think that we have to translate these things. I think it's terrible if we would not say that we can translate other cultures. I think then we cannot go into cultural philosophy us. And I think it's terrible because I think we have to translate cultures into one another, even if we know that we fail always up to a certain degree. But giving up the attempt to speak with others, understand them, and trying to translate them in your own horizon is for me one of the most important things in the global status as we are right now. So to say that only Indian can understand Indian culture and we can only understand Foucault, I think that is terrible. It's really terrible. And it's against not just of today, but against everything what happens. They were translating, for example, the Indian, I mentioned it one, the Indian philosophy you cannot understand as constant dialogue with the Arabic world. As I said, in the 19th century, in all elite families, they were speaking at least a so-called Sanskrit dialect and Arabic language at home, as many do today with English. So they were always translating. This is very important that we have this openness to translate our cultures. Now, it's terrible when we say that we cannot understand them. This is like provincializing the globe. This is like we are really in a global village. Where people from Vienna do not understand people from Munich, and if you are from one village, you cannot understand how the next village is working. Yeah? This brings us back into, I think, very dangerous. My whole life I tried to translate. That was what I did more or less in my job. The whole time, that I tried to translate European culture into Indian culture, translate it back to him, and then try to bring them in a certain kind of style. And I still think that this is not a bad thing. A bad idea. What I had in mind to exactly decenter the culture. cultures and bringing them into a dialogical way of descent. I think this is very important, therefore I absolutely admire that we learn ancient languages, that we learn non-European languages, that how can we come out of Eurocentric things without knowing any language that is not European? Yeah, probably for your career, it's better to learn all the European languages like English, you speak German and you learn English and probably you learn a little bit French or so. But that means you are learning just the colonial language. How would you like to come out from your language training? And this is a big problem, especially not so much from Europe, but this is a big problem, I think, for Anglo-Saxon culture. Because they are not, this is a big problem in America at universities. This is where they are not forced to learn any other language. And I think that's political. Not just an academic problem on the university. How would America press the claim that it rules in a certain way the world, try to rule the world if it does not know any other language than English? I think this is a big problem. And we all are forced to learn English, but if you speak English, you're not forced to learn any other language. You're free to learn. And so, I think this is a big political issue also. They are not used to translate their language into other languages. That creates a mess. Yeah? And if you look in these things, that is not just... Yeah. Okay, so we have this one general. They would say, that is this, now the same church. So the 100 or 1,000 in many fixed channels which are floating through our bodies, they come together in one channel. Yeah? And of course this one is like, now coming together and being in the middle of two or many is usually for them expressed in the term coming together in the same two century is the heart. The heart is important. So Shona, this was my theory from the beginning, and since we are at the philosophy, yes, I hope that you might really struggle together critically, that some of you would not agree. But in a certain way, that was the thing why this red line, in a certain way, is the channel of the heart, because it is the century. And it's literally for them centering the body, the human body, now in many ways. In first way, to say it naively, that's complicated. To say it in a naive way. You know, here you have always the one and two, one and two, one and two. So in a certain way, that stick. Is the channel of the heart because it's the center of your body. Yeah? That's it. And it is the Advaita channel, the non-duality channel, because I could not say this of these two points. I could not say it about these two points, or these two points. They are, our body has a duality symmetry, yeah? In a certain way. But the spine is there where the dualities are coming together, where they are centered. So the Sushumna is the center and the centering of duality principles in the body. Therefore, the Bindu we had at last meeting is so important because it's the visionary center between the two eyes. So the Bindu as a very prominent symbol of Hindu culture, yeah, which women wear maybe usually, and if you go into temple also the men become the point. Yeah. So in a certain way this is the visionary center of the two eyes. So it's the centering of the duality principle of vision. Yeah? So then the Bindu, they come together. So on one side, this one channel is the centering of our body. Yeah? So in the spine, the centering is the meat. But you can have it on other things also. If I put this into the middle, yeah, where do I locate myself? Where is the middle of the red line, approximately? It's the center of the heart. So of course, from their perspective of interpretation, I can call the whole Sushumna channel the center, and therefore the heart. But I could also call here this region to be the center of the above and the below. Yeah? So in a certain way, if I go now to the, as we would say, anatomical seat of the heart, then in a certain way we go to the center of the Sushumna now, but in the perspective of it is in the middle of the below and the above. And there I do center. So the center of the heart is both. It's the Sushumna and it's the center of the Sushumna. Yeah? So there I would say this is why for them this is quite natural, I would say, or quite common. They have no problem because sometimes they mean the Sushumna when they speak of the heart because it's the centering of the body of the relative principles. And on the other side they could say it's the heart, which again is the center of the above and the below within the Sushumna. So it has a central place. The heart, as we more in European terms would call it, to be here. Yeah? Now, if I do the same here, modern image of Vedanta, I would say. Yeah, it's factually not even much later because this is in, so my teachers in the tradition of Samkhya Yoga, which is again 800 or 1,000 years later than the Vedanta. Yeah, so even this tradition already is the image of 20th century about the tradition is here already a tradition of 4th century of our time. And we said that we are between approximately 700 and 200 before our time. Now when we go to the Vedanta, to the Upanishad. And this is already a Patanjali Yoga, which means we are already about 4th century in our time. So that's all nice to distinguish a little bit this. Yeah, and don't make it, this has always been the picture like you find in yoga books. So that's quite a complicated story, how it became a kind of iconography from today about these very ancient cultures. But of course this is something we can work with when we translate it to the combine it with the text. So here I would say this comes closer to the Rig Veda understanding. We have, what would you say, does this, we have 100 channel and one. Yeah? So I just copied this, so we have, I would say they would not see a big difference on the 100 channel. Despite of what? I mentioned it already. Here you have a typical book of, not allowed to say these all critical words. But in a certain way, here you have a way of individualization. Yeah, of them. And the difference here about the 100 seats is just as I said that they are here not just in the body, but they are also, they would be here. So if I would have more person, they would circulate, all these circles would be between the person. Yeah? And even if they are non-human, if I would have a tree here, there would also be a circle between the person and the tree. Yeah? So as I said, they were much more cosmic. So this is probably the difference of, as I would say, between this image and this image from different times. I would have to complete it with many beings that are here and they all circle out within this cosmic nature in a certain way. So that's it. But where is the, when we go to the central stick, the wave of the stick? Because the stick, also the spine, has like a wave. So it's not just a straight stick, it is a wave. And it has this. So it is also a wave and not just a flat stick. Yeah, in a circle. So it has this kind of Fragezeichen if you look to it anatomically. And here they would say, where would you see now the difference between this understanding and this understanding of the Sushumna music? Yes, and here, you, yes. So 1, 2, 3, yeah, okay, you.
Yeah, in the left image we have two ends, and the right is like this circle. It doesn't end. It ends, it goes back to the point, from the upper layers to the down, and it connects to other beings or to itself. And it has different sheets too.
Yeah? Okay, so that is what you said is exactly here. In a certain way, you have that way of sheet understanding, yeah, which you don't find now in this image, but which in a certain way is indirectly here. You have the sheets, yeah, but they are not so prominent as they would be in this thing. Of course, you have the sheets here, but this is more pulsating.
I would say that the left one is maybe the figurative or kind, and the right one is like the translation.
The
translation,
yeah,
into like maybe reality, because or maybe into rabbit, like because you mentioned Kant, and I think he's using this concept of gravity.
Yeah.
When it's like this AB thing or this connection in between, and also all the magnetic fields or the waves from life.
Yeah, I think magnetic field is good here. You have, when you have a second person, it would be like they are connecting through magnetic fields, and this, the fields would be a very important term. Yeah, in a certain way, which you have here. Here you have a very single body that is not connected environmentally, yeah, in a certain way. So it's not part of the field, yeah, of the kosher, yeah, because it would translate kosher also as field, yeah, as sheep, as field. You want it, Eric?
And what's the difference also is like in the first picture, the shunya ends on the top on the purusha chakra, but like on the other picture, it connects us with the upper ocean and with the supramental.
Exactly. So here, in a certain way, the oceans has been gone. Yeah, in this picture, you don't have the Vedic cosmic as a creation hymn where you have the lower ocean and you have the upper ocean. So that ocean has gone here. And in a certain way, as you said, you are not stopping here. This is not the top end, yeah? The purusha and the crown chakra. So this is not the top end, but it's beyond the head. Yeah? So you have to leave the human in a certain way in order to connect with the above human. Yeah? So that was at the beginning of the Veda, and now this is why I would say it becomes more anthropological, because it looks now as this would be a kind of self-reflexivity. Yeah? So this is very modern in a certain way, that you, the Purusha chakra, opens and the world looks like something in you, and you are mastering this thing. Yeah? So you are controlling, you are mastering this, because this is still part of you. Where here, in a certain way, it looks as if you have to go beyond yourself. Yeah? You have to open yourself to a beyond yourself. Yeah? That is not so easily part of your own body. Yeah? In a certain way. And we will come next to the Kashmir Christ tradition, which I like a lot. Because for me it is in a certain way coming back strongly to the Rig Veda picture, to the beginning of the Veda, and not so much to the Upanishads, so to the end of the Veda picture. So, but of course these are theories. These are things where I make a certain thesis and science does, which does not, I would not be the Pope who would make a dogma out of this. Thesis, yeah? So this is a thesis. Of course, others will probably have other interpretation, but it's my way that how I would summarize in a certain way my readings of these things. So what is interesting for me that they are not really strongly here, the lower and the upper ocean, and also where does the human end? Yeah? Here it ends, as I would say, Greek. If it's human, it must end at the top of the form. And then you have an understanding where you have to go beyond that top. Yeah? And you have to open yourself to a will that is higher than human. Yeah? And so on. So that would be a reading which I would offer, yeah? As a kind of also historical development that took place between these 1,500 years.
It's also aesthetically pretty interesting because the left one is like made by a machine, or it's like, and also the letters, it's like it looks printed, and the right one, that is also like, because you just mentioned the Greek, it looks like a metallic body kind of abstract thing in itself, or like a schemata, or like a model, and the right one is like a drawing, a painting, which is sort of like organic. Also written by your hand, so in the future, if you will find this in like 1,000 years, you know, like.
Exactly, of course, thank you. This was one of my intentions, why I did not use a circle from. Yes, of course, I have also symbols like this, the crimes and everything, which I could use. But by purpose, of course, I try not to use these technical things and do it a very ungeschickte Weise to do my kind of naive painting in order to use a kind of naivety of painting, yeah, and not a highly composed, because as you said, the Platonic figures, that's exactly geometrical figures. And these are the primarily geometrical figures, which of course you have today, everybody has on his computer. Yeah? So, but that's interesting, this is Euclidean philosophy. But that is very interesting that we are, since 19th century, no more in Euclidean geometry, but in non-Euclidean geometry from the science. But we still know a computer use the typical Platonic figures like a cubus or like a triangle or like a thing, which are the very Platonic geometric original figures. So we are, the computers are much behind natural science in this way, because they are more promoting Plato's denials than quantum physics, in a certain way. Also that would be my kind of trying to schematize these things and also make thematically visible, therefore, a kind of difference or development which I would be local in. And of course, this is very stereotypical, I can't see what this is. I think they are important because they summarize and let us see an overall development. But of course, you cannot summarize all the developments which have been within 1,000. Now, this is the right diagram, so now I can understand everything what happens between 1,500 years of cultural history. But nevertheless, even if it necessarily fails, we can learn something. If we use it rightly as an orientation, I think I am right. So I would defend it. There is a truth in my way of trying to summarize this. Okay, so I hope that you, when you hear a sentence like there are 101 channels of the heart, that this starts to make, at least from the cultural context, a little bit sense for you what they could probably mean, in which direction this goes. One of these, and now we have it, one of these passages up to the crown of the head. Right? Okay, so of course we have here top the crown of the head, which is usually the crown chakra, which is the seat of the Purusha, the soul. Yeah? And so when I said already that in many subcultures, popular cultures, but also in many spiritual traditions, this is a very important space marked by the human, since often men were traditionally in these positions, so this is where they have their special hairstyle, punk or big punk cultures in a certain way of thing, but as I said already that you find it in many spiritual cultures. So this is the crown, and of course the crown chakra has also, politically, one has to mention that of course this has a lot to do with aristocracy from a political perspective and really with the crowns of the kings. Yeah? It's not just our pope, yeah, or the cup. So you have all these caps, yeah, which are strongly marking this place culturally. Yeah? Think of the European aristocrats, yeah, which have the crown here, and you have the Pope, yeah, who has this very special privileged hands. So this you have invented the Jewish, of course, you have here the cap, yeah, and you have in many traditions a kind of symbolic emphasis, yeah? Like when you make in language a Rufezeichen, or when you emphasize something, underline. So that is in many cultures underlined as being very privileged. And of course, I said it already, this has to do a lot also with very classical ancient interpretation of death, the relation of death and soul. Because in many cultures, your soul leaves the body through the sushumna, or a kind of sushumna, not just in Indian, in many traditions, and therefore the opening of this chakra is very important. You name it differently in different cultures, but in a certain way it's placed, I think this is strongly connected also with death. Yeah? So that has to do a lot. So if it says in the Orthodox Brahmin context, if you die and you go up this channel, you go directly, yeah, into the highest, and so it's the golden channel which brings you to the highest realms. And so I think this is not just a thing of the body and understanding. So for me, philosophically, it's really important here to problematize how we understand culturally bodies. Yeah? How do you understand the body? Because it's like, body, it's simply clear, but this is the body with a contour. But are you aware that you are hiding in a certain culture when you perceive bodies from the contour? So of course, philosophically, this is one of the aims to problematize the so-called natural understanding of what the body is. That's not so natural as we need. This is strongly shaped by history in the broadest sense. Okay, yeah, and of course here, when you say here, if this person, we go back to the text. So one of these passes up to the crown of the head. This is very heavy. And then it going up by it, one goes to immortality. So that goes strongly that in these cultures, if you could go, if this person could go from the mula Prakriti and Muladhara chakra, as from the root chakra, and it could walk, channel. This is how they saw my interpretation, what we call psychomental. So they would say, your consciousness, your awareness is traveling always through this channel. Yeah? So what Europeans call psychic is in fact the awareness of this walking through the layers of the channel. Yeah? This would be my reading. So if somebody can have a strong awareness here, yeah, for example, if women are pregnant, they have, of course, a strong awareness of what is going on in their womb. Yeah? So that would highlight and create strong awareness about this region. The heart region, which you can feel during the day. Yeah? This is the mental region, which you feel during the day by thinking strongly. So your awareness, your psychomental awareness, is focusing on this region. And what you call awareness is that it appears in this channel. So then it's in consciousness. Yeah? So if something happened here, and here outside of the channel, and it comes not into the sushumna, you have no awareness. Yeah? So you can, the sushumna can become aware of what happens here and feel something in the fingers, because in a certain way this nadi goes into the central nadi, and this also becomes part of your nervous system. If it does not come back, you don't feel. Yeah? So you are, this river is there, but it is not connected to your awareness. So this is how our causes also for them would function. Yeah? If you are in a coma, you can touch this body. So probably the electromagnetic impulse is still going, but it is not registered by your spine. So therefore, for you it is as if it would not be, because it's not coming into the channel of consciousness. So it's not part of your psychomental awareness, which you have. And here, of course, they would say, if many people, this is very classical in yoga tradition, Patanjali, so the most people cannot go beyond this center. So that means they stop, their soul, their psychomental awareness stops with some, this block here. There is a barrier, and therefore they cannot perceive the Purusha, because their souls end here, they are blocked. They do not come to this awareness, because they would not have this part of not. We have now sequence in the chi, and they would say a soul has no access if it is blocked here. This is why this is so important, because it opens the blockage that in a certain way brings to the awareness of the Purusha, which people usually do not have, or you know, yeah, or rarely people have that open sushumna, because up till the having, so this is why they have a block aklesha. Classic aklesha's are the blockers, the hindrances which hinder you to open up and be able to go up the hole. And if you can, a free soul in the classical yoga would be one who can freely wander through all these. He's a free soul, yeah? So he can wander up from the very below to the up and from the below, ascend and descend together. This is also why we have Ida and Pingali. So they ascend and they descend, and they can in a certain way run through the whole soul. They have a fully developed soul. Yeah? And therefore they have a fully developed awareness. Yeah? Psychomental awareness. And if you don't travel this, then you have no awareness about these reaches. Yeah? Because they are there, but you are not aware of them. Yeah? So this is why in Buddhism especially you have this strong focus on creating awareness. Yeah? So you have really to create an awareness, because that awareness allows you to travel freely in your concepts in the middle of all the 100 or 1,000 Wales, we shot the Wales. You?
Does everyone have the potential to have this free soul, or are there
yes.
that are blocked?
Yeah, this is on in every Indian philosophy, as far as I know, you have this Shunya, the potential. But of course, then you have certain traditions which, in fact, as in German, you would have to say, or in English, you would have to say, in principle, you have. Why? Because here in the principle, it is laid down. When you are born into these principles, and therefore everybody has this principle. It's not that you have the principle, but you are inborn into the tapas. So the tapas are there before you are born. Yeah? So when you are born, and this is true for anybody, not just for the human body, any particle is born into the principles, into the tapas. And this is very important, this is why I emphasize this. We have lost the strength because we had this also in the European traditions. I remember many times, if you read German idealism, you cannot understand anything without this presupposition. That it's not the subject that thinks principle, but the subject is inborn into the principle. This is the big thing of, but this is true for Aristotle, this is true for the whole tradition of continental philosophy. Otherwise, you cannot understand what reason means. Because reason is the capacity to understand the tapas and the principles. And they are not subjective. It's not that you as a human subject have certain ideas about reason. It's the opposite. You as human being are inborn into the principle of the Weltvernunft, as Aristotle says. This is not a subjective thing for them, reason. This is not at all, and Kant is very dangerous here, because Kant is in a certain way, he still understands this, of course, but with him, in a certain way, it becomes a very, very thin line not to interpret reason as being just a subjective capacity of human beings. Kant is exactly the borderline. It's exactly the borderline that pushed so-called bürgerliche philosophy after Kant reads Kant wrong. They read him wrong. Why? Because now and already very much Anglo-Saxist, yeah? More and more becoming Anglo-Saxish, they interpret reason to be a capacity of the human subject, which is absolutely absurd. For German ideas. It's the opposite. And this is not Heidegger carryover, but this is so obvious. And this is still why they were reading Aristotle at least. And in Aristotle, nous means the world principles, not a human subjectivity. The human subject is inborn into the principles of the world, and the human subject has the capacity. It has, since it has intellectus, as Lewis is translated intellectus, the intellectus allows us human beings to understand the principle of the world. But now it changed that the human intellectus start to fantasize the principle. So, oh, that's just a subjective opinion. This is the world in which we live today, but this is a disaster. This is a philosophical disaster because we do not understand what reason would mean for thousands of years. It's not a subjective capacity of the human being. That's one of the big mistakes of the last 100 centuries. It's the opposite. You are inborn into cosmic principles, and they have been called in Greek philosophy nous. And this has been translated into intellectus, which still was objective in the middle. This had nothing to do with subjectivity. And it still Kant had nothing to do, but Kant starts to anthropologize slowly. And now reason becomes a capacity of human being. It becomes intellect in the today's sense, which is a disaster for somebody like us, which is a cultural disaster, because it is no more understanding the ancient cultures, which are the old cultures. You cannot have a dialogue with them anymore if you don't understand this distinction. That would be my zeal. You cannot have a dialogue with them anymore, because you will always say, oh, they have a subjective philosophy. But then you are individualizing these things, and you take your subject to be the ground of reason. So your subject starts to be the principle that governs reason in that way, that it creates something like a fantasy of reason. And this is exactly what culturally for me happened in the last 200 years. You're in liberals, and then you say you are against neoliberals. That's the next thing, but that is the very heartbeat of man. You subjectivize this, you make them human attributes and eulogies. So you have the opinion. You have the opinion, and then you come into the struggle that you have the opinion that light is going at the speed of light. And you say, oh no, that's no principle, that's just a subjective hypothesis. And you come into all these struggles which we have to bring, because you cannot accept from that point that principle as principle still exists, which would mean that they exist independently of your opinion. Light does go with the velocity of light, either if you like it or not. It's just not a matter of your opinion. You can just recognize it, or you can suppress it. Yeah? Because the diseases of Einstein was not that he had a subjective meaning about how quick life got, but that he had the meaning that he discovered a principle. He discovered the principle of the relation of mass and speed and light, energy. And if you accept that it's a principle, it's no opinion for you. Yeah? That's a disaster to make. Oh, Einstein, yeah, he was a clever man. Yeah, he had that idea. Good. Wow, great. So he had this objective thing. But then you have to explain me why atom bombs work. Why all that, what is built on the things, why these measurements work everywhere. Yeah? If this is a subjective opinion of Mr. Einstein, who was a clever, subjective, genius individual, then you have to explain me why these things work on a cosmic relation, and not just of a subjective, I'm in a talk show and I tell you, I have to mean that A is M mal C quadrat. And then, oh, I have the other meaning. But then you don't accept that this is a principle, a purpose. Huh? And this is the claim what I said, that they were still in Greek, especially they were Greek, is a big culture of thinking principles. And that's the big thing when I said some bad things about Greek. Here to criticize the Greeks, but what is big and what one today can learn about them is they thought in archaic, and that means archaic has been translated in Latin with principle. So they are thinkers of the archaic. What is the archaic means? What is the principle? Yeah? And that makes Greek philosophy so big. And they said, I'm not speaking about you and you, I speak about the prince. I speak about the anarchy. So that is that thing. So going up, that if one goes to immortality. So in a certain way here, it is more the subject already tries to understand immortality. Here I have to go to the upper ocean, which has been there before the creation of the world. So in a certain way, these are Burusha, Prakriti, are eternal principles, and here we have the mediation, which means again here, the heart means the middle between the upper and the lower ocean. If the heart for them is the term for centering and mediation, then the centering here is not just this, and this is why they would say it's the heart of the world. And they would not use this as a method to make as just as we would say, oh, the real heart is the heart which you have here, and then we can use it and transport it into the cosmos. This is a real non-understanding. This is really a non-understanding of discussion, because I would claim that they would take the opposite. This heart which we mean here is a metaphor of the real heart, which is cosmic. There is a cosmic heart, and we are part of that cosmic heart. And not the real heart is the human heart, and the other is just, we use it now metaphorically. That I would call laziness of thinking. So this is laziness where my metaphor makes it very easy. So literally, this is the heart, and metaphorically in poetry and so we can then speak of the heart of the world. But I think my claim here is that they saw this relation reverse to how we do. So the real heart is the cosmic heart, and all our beings are participating in this. So in a certain way, here the Sushumna is not primary, it is going, therefore this is how I make it understandable for me, but they would say the human body is much more a passage, a going through, a medium or mediation of the cosmic heart. So my walking here through the Sushumna, and some people, some rishis, there the top of the, while they were living, the top of their heart, so to say, of the human top, did open, and then they could rise, as they say, into the upper ocean. And from there they got their inspiration. And this is also already, this looks very much the card as I think. So I am the master, so I think, and my thinking opens the wheel to the absolute broad understanding of the world. Here in a certain way you have self and archaic, and I, for me, archaic is not discriminating. I appreciate again archaic modes of thinking. Here it's very clear, it's going that beyond, and this is an inspirational concept of thinking. And this is very important for me, because this is exactly the critique of Nietzsche of Descartes. That the model, I think I mentioned it already in the Jenseits von Gut und Böse, the Encore der Liebe, Nietzsche says, what is the suspicion of the logic? It's the Aberglaube der Logik. It's written. And there he says, they always think that I am thinking, that I am the subject of thinking. And this is at the very heart of the beginning of modernity, that the I is the one who creates songs. When I speak of inspirational models, the soul is coming from the outside. It's not me who is the genius who creates so brilliant songs. But in a certain way, here it looks very much that he's so genius that he can, in a certain way, think it out of himself. But here, in a certain way, what they experienced is that when this opens suddenly, surprisingly, and they wonder what happens with them, they feel more like being a medium or something. Something happens to them. They have it not under control to wonder. So it happens to them, and suddenly the thoughts are falling from the upper ocean as if golden rain. These are typical pictures. So in a certain way, the thought And I think Europe is the probably only culture of humanity who thinks that thoughts are generated out of oneself. So Münchhausen, I am producing, I am the producer of myself. But I would claim that almost any other culture that I knew, where that thoughts are coming from the others. Yeah, that, and this, they call therefore thoughts the inspiration. This means for me, from a philosophical point, that the subject is receiving the thoughts. That's their experience. So inspirational means that it's the other who is triggering the thoughts in myself. And the thoughts are not a self-generated thing that is produced simply out of my genius subjectivity. And so I would claim that this is not evident for them. And if you think how many, almost everything what I am telling here is inspiration, not in the sense of, oh, I am the one who has been touched by the grace of the law, but because what I am saying is mostly a quote of my readings. So the readings inspire me to tell you the stories I'm telling. They are not just subjectively created out of the genius of my person, but they are I think it's less if I say 95%, I think it's much more than 99% of everything what I said so far is inspirational in the sense that it came to me in that way, in a not at all esoteric manner, in that I did not produce these thoughts myself, but I in a certain way was producing these thoughts in the close reading of these texts. So without this text, I could not have, that's my theory, I could not tell you almost nothing of them what I told you now without reading. But is now the reading of the text a genius subjective act in my person or a relation toward the world? And so I was inspired by the world in which I live in to tell you what I'm telling you. That means that these thoughts are not just an expression of my genius subjectivity, but they are coming out of relational affairs, as I would say, in which I try to understand my being here out of my reading of, for example, these texts. Yeah? And this is why subject and subjectivity, my teacher would never have really written his name beyond his teaching. Because he would say this has been given to him. Yeah? This has been given to him, and he in a certain way is rather giving this back to other people. So the inspirational does not at all mean for me a kind of strange esoteric higher forces, but it for me means strongly that my subjectivity is a relational affair that is constituted to in and out of relations toward the world. And I would not be the one without this relation. This is very much what new materialism. Of course, many of the discourses today would say that we have to think of relational ontologies rather than thinking in terms of subjectivity. Okay, so since this was the last meeting,